Imagine. It's getting late, and you just finished up watching some television. You are going about your nightly routine. You turn the TV off, lock up the doors, and turn out all of the interior lights. You make sure your curtains and blinds are pulled shut. But before you close the last mini blind, a bright light from outside catches your eyes. You peer through the blinds and your eyes adjust. Hovering over the trees in the distance is a bluish, glowing light. It is still for some time, long enough for your curiosity to grow, and you head to the front door. You step outside and watch in wonder. What is that? You ask yourself. Your senses adjust to the darkness of the night. You hear the swaying of the branches in the breeze and the sounds of the summer insects chirping. But you don't notice any sound coming from this craft that seems to be hovering, and you can't quite make out the source of the light. It hovers a few moments longer, then slowly begins to dip below the tree line. The trees obstruct the view, but you know it's still there. Then, this light begins to ascend slowly, once again hovering above the trees. Then, without warning, it zips up at a speed that your eyes can't follow and disappears into the dark night sky. It somehow managed to silently slip away from view. Bewildered and shaken by the experience, you question your sanity, but know that you were not hallucinating. Your heart is beating a little faster and you grow a little excited because you know that you just witnessed an unidentified flying object. You are listening to episode They Are Among Us, the Pascagoula Abduction Case. I am your host, Carrie, and this is Unlocking the Paranormal. Thank you for tuning into another episode, and if this is your first time here, I do appreciate you taking the time to listen. In honor of World UFO Day, which lands on July 2nd, today's episode will explore the infamous and bizarre Pascagoula, Mississippi abduction case. One of the nation's most documented abductions and UFO sighting cases. I do want to preface by saying that a large part of the information comes straight from Calvin Parker, one of the men who was abducted. He shared in more than one book, Pascagoula, The Closest Encounter, My Story, as well as Pascagoula, The Story Continues, New Evidence and New Witnesses, and the book Beyond Reasonable Doubt, The Pascagoula Alien Abduction, written by Philip Mantle and Irina McCammon Scott, PhD, with the help and approval of Calvin Parker. Transport yourself back to the quiet shores of Pascagoula, Mississippi, where Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson embarked on a fishing trip that would change their lives forever. It was October 11th, 1973, and Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson just finished a day shift at the F.B. Walker and Sons shipyard. Calvin, 18, and Charles, 42, were not only co-workers, but were friends that felt like family. You see, Calvin was a good friend of Charles's son, Eddie, and Charles was longtime friends with Calvin's father. They grew up together and were very close. Charles was a foreman at the shipyard who hired Calvin, and it just so happened to be Calvin's first day on the job. On that quiet Thursday afternoon, Charles and Calvin left work and headed back to Charles' apartment for a quick change of clothes and set out to go fishing. The two decided to embark on a fishing trip on the calm shores of Pascagoula River in Mississippi as they headed out the door at 5:45 p.m. Charles told his wife that they would be back in a couple of hours. They made it to the first fishing spot, and Charles was working with great effort to catch redfish and speckled trout, but they were not biting. They eventually tried a few more spots along the river, but with no luck. Not willing to give up easily, Charles had suggested to Calvin that they try an abandoned shipyard, where he previously had caught many fish before. Calvin agreed. They made their way over to the spot, all while making plans to go fishing that following Saturday. The first thing Calvin noticed is that they had to park about 100 feet away from the actual fishing site. The shipyard had been out of business for a very long time, and the marsh grass had grown in. Calvin had noticed the old road had become littered with trash that had been washed out from people's homes and scattered around. About 300 yards to their left was a high-rise toll bridge that was part of Highway 90. The bridge was tall enough to allow large ships to pass under it. They pushed their way through the brushy, tall grass and made it to an old steel pier. Calvin questioned its stability, but upon inspection, it looked stable enough to fish from. They found an old stump to sit on and settled into their spots along the East River. The sun had just set, and Charles was eager for a good catch. He went to add fresh bait to his lure, and he was in the process of turning around to grab fresh bait that was sitting behind them, when something stopped him in his tracks. He was frozen in fear. Charles heard a zipping sound in about 60 to 70 feet away with some kind of craft that was lowering to the ground. It was about this time that Calvin turned around, and he too noticed something odd in the distance. He noticed blue hazy lights. His first thought was that the police were there and they were going to have to go somewhere else to fish. But then he noticed the object behind the light. They glanced at each other in confusion, and they couldn't believe their eyes. Aside from the zipping noise, it was completely silent. The only thing they noticed was the pulsating blue light, or what could have been a revolving blue light. The craft hovered about 1.5 to 2 feet off the ground. There were no visible signs of any airplane wings. At this point in time, Charles was questioning a lot. How is this possible? Was there anyone on board? Who is manning this craft? In his very own words, he was spellbound. Charles thought to himself, quote, "Maybe it will just leave. We can run for the car and get the hell out of here," end quote. According to Charles, the craft looked about 30 feet long, and both thought was 8 or 10 feet high. It was shaped like a football. It was more blunt at one end with a small dome-like structure on the top. Something towards the top of one end resembled two windows. Then, an opening appeared in the end that was facing them. Charles noticed that through the opening, the inside seemed to glow. Calvin found himself blinded by the light and screamed in fear. His mind began to think of a way out of the situation, but before he could make up his mind, it was too late. From what Charles recalled happened, from inside the craft, two beings glided out of the opening, and they hovered about a foot to a foot and a half off the ground. The following is a description of what the creature looked like based on Charles' description in the book Beyond Reasonable Doubt, The Pascagoula Alien Abduction. The head seemed to come directly to the shoulders, no neck, and something resembled a nose, come out to a point about 2 inches long. On each side of the head, about where the ears would be, was something similar to the nose. Directly under the nose was a slit, resembling a mouth. The arms were something like human arms, but long in proportion to the body. The hands resembled mittens. There was a thumb attached. The legs remained together, and the feet looked something like an elephant's feet. The entire body was wrinkly. It had grayish color. There could have been eyes, but the area above the nose was so wrinkled that I couldn't tell. Calvin describes what he saw in a similar way. According to Calvin, when the door on the craft slid open and the blinding light spilled out, 3 creatures floated out of the craft. He described them as, quote, gray-colored, wrinkled-skinned creatures, shortish in size, about 5 feet tall, more or less, and stocky-looking gray in color with no facial features, just floating about 2 feet off of the ground. And he continued on saying, I didn't see any feet. Charlie then goes on to describe what happened after these beings reached him. He claims that 2 of them took hold of his arms, 1 on each side, and then, in his left arm, he felt pain. But just as quickly as the pain was there, it was gone. It was after this prick of pain that he became helpless and he could not move. He had lost all sensation or feeling. All Charlie could think about was if he would be another story in the headlines about a man who disappeared and vanished into thin air. Calvin corroborated this claim. He explained that 2 of the creatures took a hold of Charlie while 1 grabbed his left arm. He heard a shot of air. And as soon as this happened, he felt instantly relaxed, and he didn't care what happened to him. His left arm wore a puncture mark from where he was grabbed. It wasn't until Calvin was grabbed by the creatures that he realized their hands did not look human. Instead, they looked like claws of a crab with a pincher-like appendage. He also claims he did not get a good look at their face, because he did not see any facial features. But, from what Charlie reports, their possible face features were not distinguishable in a human context. From here, Calvin claims his body floated towards the ship. He could see everything that was happening around him, but he could not control it, move, or speak. Once on board the craft, things got even more strange. Charlie describes the inside as well lit, to the point that it was almost blinding. But despite the blinding light, he couldn't close his eyes. Then coming out directly from the wall was something weird. It had resembled a large eye. At this point, he felt pain in his left arm once again. The large eye that came out from the wall got face to face, or eye to eye, with Charles. He describes the end of it to be a different color and material than the rest of it. The eye began to scan his body, then does a second scan. As for Calvin, once he floated onto the ship, He recalls taking an immediate left into a room that was extremely bright. He could not tell where the light source was illuminating from, as there didn't appear to be any actual lights. He then states that his body floated into a 45-degree angle, as if he was placed onto a table, but he could not feel anything below him. He lost sight of Charles, and he was unable to move his head to look around. Then, the creature that brought him in left the room. He suddenly heard a clicking noise. The clicking noise seemed to generate from this blue-looking square box, about the size of a deck of cards, with a silver button that went around him. He heard it clicking about 4 times total. After this, a smaller being entered the room. He said that it made him feel safe. He describes this being as being about 5 feet tall with brown eyes and a thin face. It was still light gray in color, but it was more pleasant looking compared to the other creatures that he describes as ugly. With his state of mind, he felt as if he were drugged, but if he wasn't, he feels like he could have overpowered the creature. Then, he heard a hissing noise, and after that something spoke to him, almost in the form of a mind reading or telepathy, and he heard the words, "Don't be afraid." But these words didn't seem to emanate from this creature's mouth, as it did not move as he heard the words. Then, something came out of the wall, and it circled his body, from his head to his toes. Calvin began to think that he was under control of the government and was being subject to an experiment. He really was trying to rationalize the situation that he was in. Once the more pleasant-looking human creature left the room, the other larger, more machine-like, uglier creatures, as he describes, came back into the room and grabbed a hold of his arm. He then felt his body floating upwards, and he turned to the right and was being brought out of the craft and was then dropped off at the same location that he was taken from. Except, this time, he was not facing the craft. He was now facing the river. He was stuck, standing in a position with his arms out, and he claims that he remembers he could not put his arms down. Still unable to move, with zero sensation, Charles attempted to wiggle his toes but was unable to do so. He was frozen in this spot for a few more minutes, and Calvin was not in sight. The weird creatures approached him once again. They took a hold of him and had control of him, as they did before. The opening in the wall appeared again, and they glided towards it. They glided back towards the area where they initially took him, and he was eventually released. Charles fell to the ground as his legs gave out. He glanced over and saw Calvin standing there with his arms outright, almost in a state of shock. His face expressed nothing but pure terror. Charles crawled towards him, but was able to rise to his feet just as he reached him. Then they both heard this zipping sound once again. Charles noticed the blue flashing lights, and within an instant, they were gone. He recalled a weird thought racing through his mind. Quote, "We are peaceful. We meant you no harm." End quote. Charles was convinced that they had been contacted by something beyond our planet, and he was praying without any physical harm. Charles grabbed a hold of Calvin and shook him back to reality. And as he did, Calvin cried out, "No, no, please don't!" Shaking him again once more, Calvin finally relaxed and fell to the ground, screaming. It took Calvin a bit of time to realize that it was Charlie approaching him and shaking him and not the creatures. Calvin was concerned that the creatures were there to do more to them. But Charles tried to reassure him that they were gone. Charles recalls Calvin asking him if they had died and come back to life. He was still a little unsure if they were actually okay. Calvin was adamant that they'd forget what happened and just not tell anyone. They sat on the ground for a bit to take what had happened to them all in. Calvin acknowledged to Charlie at this point in time that he didn't see the creature had any eyes, and he questioned how it is that they could see anything if there were no eyes. This was confirmation to Charles about what it was he saw. They both sat there debating on whether or not they should tell someone, possibly military authorities. They packed up their fishing gear and headed back to the car. Once back to the car, Calvin noticed that the windows on the passenger side were shattered, but had not fallen out yet. Then, they got into the car and couldn't get it to start, which Calvin thought was odd, as it was a new car. Once the car did start, after several attempts, it sounded rough. They drove around for a bit as they went back and forth about if they should tell someone, anyone, about what they experienced. Then, according to Calvin, Charles asked him to pull over so he could go see what time it was. He ran into the Mississippi Press building, but upon emerging from the building, he still had no idea as they didn't have a clock inside of the building. From here, according to Calvin, he found a tiki pub and ordered a beer to unwind, until Charlie convinced him to take him to a payphone. So, they sought out a payphone and rang the operator and asked for Kessler Air Force Base in Biloxi. The town of Biloxi is about 30 minutes north of Pascagoula. The operator answered, and Charles explained to her what had happened to them. But, to their surprise, she said that the military didn't handle those things, and she directed them to the local sheriff's department. Charles and Calvin debated a little bit more if they should tell the sheriff's department. They thought that they would think that they were crazy. Eventually, they decided to call the sheriff's department, but agreed that they would not tell anyone else. The deputy answered and directed them to come down to the department so they could talk about it. They had immensely prepared themselves before stepping into the sheriff's department. They feared that they would be ridiculed and laughed at and made fun of. As they made their way inside, they were separated, where they each told their story. And not just one time, but multiple times. As for Calvin, the truth was a little more complicated. He recalled Charles advising him that if they told anyone, he would tell them that Calvin had passed out. So, that is the story Calvin told the deputy. They then brought the two together in the same room, where they questioned them, and then left them alone. What Charles and Calvin didn't know is that the sheriff attempted to catch them in a lie. They had left a tape recorder lying in the room recording their conversation, but as the sheriff would discover, the conversation they had played back on that tape convinced them even more that they were in fact being truthful. The sheriff then pulled them both back into the same room and began questioning them again, but this time together. Both Calvin and Charlie were still unaware of the tape recording. The sheriff made them a promise not to tell anyone and advised them to go home, and they did just that. Calvin thought that it was odd that the police did not go out to the site that night, or run any tests or check the damages to the vehicle. They just let them go home. I imagine that the police were not equipped to handle this kind of case, and because it wasn't a criminal matter, they didn't think to investigate to the full extent. Wishing to move on from what had happened, they learned that in the days to come, that putting this event behind them would be impossible. The subsequent media frenzy thrust the case into the public eye, igniting a mix of fascination, skepticism, and speculation. Polygraph tests and hypnosis sessions were conducted, adding layers of complexity to the case. The following are details regarding the first few days after the event took place. On Friday, the next day, they both got up around 4 a.m. to head out to work. Both exhausted from not sleeping the night before and still reeling from what had happened to them the day prior, it made the workday more challenging. But what they didn't know was that their workday would be cut short. In the middle of the workday, Charles was notified that he received a call. He got on the phone and learned that the call was long distance, from Jackson, Mississippi. And, on the other line, was a reporter. This reporter was called about the event that had happened the very day before. Charles replied no comment, then immediately got off the phone. Then it seemed as if the phones were ringing off the hook for both Charlie and Calvin. Charles' first thought is that the sheriff did not keep his words and leaked their story to the press. Charlie then phoned the sheriff, and the sheriff claims that he did not leak the story, but admitted that keeping this type of story a secret was never going to happen. Angry and upset, Charlie said a few words to the sheriff and slammed the phone down and hung up. Some of his coworkers overheard the conversation and noticed that he was upset. This is when both Charlie and Calvin decided to share what had happened to them with some of their coworkers. One of them, named Jim, who was the foreman at the shipyard and personal friend of Charles, had an artistic talent and knew how to draw. He decided to sketch what both Calvin and Charlie described as coming out of the spacecraft. Eventually, the news of the phone calls and the excitement of the shipyard made its way over to the general manager, Oliver Bryant. He called them both up to his office. He asked them to explain to him what was going on and what had happened to them. They both did, and Oliver thought it was best that they have legal representation, and they both agreed. Then, a well-known attorney named Joe was called in and debriefed. From there, they were taken back to the sheriff's office per their request. But this time, news crews were a frenzy to get the scoop. They surrounded the sheriff's office. They were eager to hear for statements. Once they got inside the sheriff's office, their lawyer, Joe, had requested that they take a lie detector test. But the sheriff's office did not have the equipment. The sheriff also didn't feel the need to have one completed after the secret tape recording the night before. The closest lie detector test was in Mobile, Alabama, and they did not want to participate, as they didn't want any publicity from this event. It was between all the back and forth of whether or not they should take a lie detector test that it dawned on Charles that they could have been exposed to radiation. He immediately began to panic, as he would have already exposed his family and coworkers to possible radiation by going home that night and going to work the next day. He mentioned his concerns to his lawyer and to the sheriff, and they immediately led them out the back door and into a car and rushed them over to the Singing River Hospital in Pascagoula. They arrived at the hospital to be tested, but when they arrived, the physician stated that they did not have the facilities to test for radiation. That is when Tom Huntley, who was the law enforcement officer within Jackson County, called Kessler Air Force Base and asked them to be examined there. When they arrived, the military personnel that was to perform the tests were in full suits to prevent any radiation exposure. And, as luck would have it, the test reported no signs of radiation. Once they were cleared of radiation contamination, they were interviewed by intelligence officers at the Air Force base. Charlie then shared his experience, and Kelvin had to keep up with the story he had shared at the sheriff's office, that he simply had passed out. Kelvin felt like they were there for hours being interviewed by the Air Force officers. He felt like Charlie thrived on telling the story and had troubles getting past it and letting it go. That is what Kelvin wanted so badly, was to just let go and move on and forget about it. On Saturday, October 13th, 1973, both Charles and Kelvin agreed to meet with Dr. James Harder, a professor at the University of California, who was associated with the Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization, APRO, and Dr. J. Allen Hynek, professor of astronomy at Northwestern University, to speak about the events. A central point was set up at John Walker's office at the shipyard. Prior to making it into the office, they were confronted by numerous TV and news crews who wanted to know the story. People were glued to them. The fascination grew deeper and deeper. Dr. Harder arrived and they sat down to go over some details. Some of the questions they were able to answer, but some they were not. Then, Dr. Harder announced that he would like to speak to them once Dr. Hynek arrived, and then that they would be put under a hypnotic state. Both Kelvin and Charles were apprehensive about being hypnotized. Charles felt like they were going to pick his mind, and he was worried what effect it would have on him. Eventually, Charles gave in, and he agreed to go under hypnosis. The hypnosis proved to be too much, and at one point in time, they had to bring Charles out of it. With tears rolling down his face, he pulled himself together. It was now Calvin's turn. Charles feared for Kelvin, knowing that originally he had lied about not remembering passing out. Charles let him lie because he saw the amount of fear that was on his face after they were let out of the spaceship. He was worried that Kelvin would mentally break if he was forced to relive the moments from that day. Kelvin didn't last very long under hypnosis. And it didn't take long for Dr. Hynek to make a statement to the news press. The following are quotes directly from the book Beyond Reasonable Doubt. "They are not unbalanced people. They're not crackpots. There was something here that was not terrestrial," said Dr. Harder. "Where they came from and why they were here is a matter of conjecture. But the fact that they are here on this planet is true, beyond a reasonable doubt." After the press finally got their story, it still took a major toll on both Charles and Kelvin. Struggling more, Kelvin wished that they would have just killed him instead. And Charles was worried about what his family would think. Charles woke up on Sunday morning to find an article covered in the newspaper regarding the press conference the day prior. Some of the details of the article state that there were 1,042 cases reported that previous year of various sorts, some including incredible tales. The newspaper article continues on with Dr. Hynek's statement, stating that they are both completely solid and honest. They are not unbalanced people. The two displayed feelings of terror under hypnosis that would be virtually impossible to fake. Seeing those words in the article was a little bit of a reassurance for Charles. Then, on Monday, in an attempt to get back to their normal routine, Charles and Kelvin headed out to work. But their plan was foiled. The phone calls, the news people, and visitors were relentless. Many people wanted to speak directly to them. They were told by management to take a few weeks off, hoping that the story would fade within that time. Worried about the money that they would be missing out on, they reluctantly agreed. During that time, the deputy director of the International UFO Bureau of Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, along with his wife, visited Charles and Calvin to sit down and hear their story. Along with that, two women who made a very long trip from Connecticut arrived in Pascagoula to speak with them about what had happened. One of the women was a good friend of Betty and Barney Hill, the couple that had reportedly been taken on board a UFO just 12 years prior. This woman explained that the experience had ruined the Hills' lives, and Betty Hill hoped that somehow this incident would help prove their story. After that, Charles and Betty wrote to each other about their abductions. The constant pressure and scrutiny of everyone around them took a toll. After 1 week, Calvin went back to Jones County to visit his family, and while he was there, he suffered a nervous breakdown. He was then hospitalized and remained there for a while and refused to speak to any news media and didn't return to Pascagoula for a long time, even to visit. Charles eventually returned to work, but the reporters and visitors and phone calls were still relentless. Then, shortly after, Charles took a polygraph test and passed. Then, there were even more visitors, phone calls, and news reporters. He could not get away from what had happened. Although Charles and Calvin were corroborated by results of the polygraph tests and hypnosis, not everyone believed them. It wasn't until years later that more people came forward about having their own experience on the night of October 11th, 1973. The first eyewitness encounter I will discuss was reported by Larry Booth, a Pascagoula service station owner, as well as a World War II Air Corps veteran. The following details were shared in an interview in August 1974. Mr. Booth had just finished up watching his show, Kung Fu, that had aired at 8 p.m. and got over at 9 p.m. His normal night routine includes checking the front door, making sure all the lights are turned off. While at the front door, he just happened to glance out the window when he saw a large object. He guessed the object was about 5 to 8 feet above a telephone pole. He said the large object was very still, not moving at all, but it had lights around the outside of it that were turning in a clockwise motion. He claims that the lights were red with no other color. He said the object was very large, but did not appear to have any wings or offsets. He stated it looked to be larger than the props on a helicopter. Larry stated, "The most noticeable and notable thing about the object were all of the lights that went around it. They were very close together and seemed to be circling the object." He guessed the circling motion to be slower than the speed of ambulance lights. The object then began moving further away. With it, he could see less and less lights on the object. He stated that whatever it was, it made absolutely no sound whatsoever. He stated that it started to move off in a slow motion over the pine trees, and he watched it until it was out of sight. As it was moving away, he was then able to make out the shape of the object, which he claimed was dome-shaped. His initial thought was that Kessler Air Force Base was conducting some kind of experiment. In that moment, he really wasn't concerned about what he was witnessing. It wasn't until he saw the news the next day but he got a little nervous about what he had witnessed. After hearing the story of the abduction and what time of day it was, he guessed that the object he saw was related to the abduction. He based this on the direction that he first spotted the object, the time of day he saw it, and the direction that it had moved when it left his view of sight. Then, he was frightened, shocked, and thought he was going to, quote, swallow his tongue. The second story didn't emerge until late 2000. Retired Chief Petty Officer Mike Cataldo waited many years to come forward with his story, and by the time he did, the massive interest and intrigue died down over the years. I myself never even heard of this story until conducting my research for this episode. Mike attempted to contact the original reporter in Pascagoula that broke the story, but was put in touch with Natalie Chambers of the Associated Press. He unburdened himself of his encounter, and with his testimony, provided additional credibility to the abduction story of Charles and Calvin. According to Mike, on October 11, 1973, he, along with fellow crewmates Ted Peralta and Mac Hanna, were driving down US 90, heading to Ocean Springs. Mike, while sitting in the back seat, saw a very strange object on the horizon, going from northeast across Highway 90. It appeared to be moving at a fast rate. He saw it go down into a wooded area and into the marsh. He stated it hovered over the tree line for about a minute. Curious at this point in time, the three men had pulled off the road and watched it in astonishment. They wondered the same thing. God, what is that? And while there were other motorists on the road, they seemed to be the only car that stopped to witness this strange phenomenon. Mike describes the object as being a large tambourine with lights flashing. He stated that as quickly as they saw it, it vanished. But his sighting does not end there. He reports a second sighting, only moments later, but this time in St. Andrews, near his home. He stated that it wasn't as high up as they saw the first time. It was real low to the ground. He describes the object big as any big American airliner, bigger than he had ever seen. This was based off of being less than a half a mile away from the object. He stated that he began to basically hyperventilate and ran inside the house to tell his wife. He knew the importance and significance of this sighting, and as a member of the pre-commissioning crew of the USS Tunney that was under construction at the Ingalls shipyard, he knew he had to report what he saw to the Navy. The next day, he reported for work and immediately contacted his executive officer to make a statement. After that weekend, he contacted Kessler Air Force Base and had to leave his phone number. But Kessler Air Force Base never returned his call. Not only that, his executive officer and crew members thought Mike, Ted, and Mac were all just lunatics. He didn't learn of the Hickson-Parker abduction until days later. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until that following Sunday that he saw the headline in the morning paper. Natalie Chambers of the Associated Press attempted to contact the other two fellow Navy witnesses to obtain a statement from them, but was unsuccessful. What my questions are: why didn't the executive officer dismiss their claims as lunacy even after the story broke of the abduction? Why didn't they come forward and state, yes, we too have men that reported the sightings? Or was the Navy trying to keep this on the down low? Last but not least, I have saved the biggest corroborating eyewitness report for last. This report was kept a secret for 45 years. It was finally brought to light after a deathbed confession. The account gives me chills just thinking about it. Maria Blair was at her husband, Jerry Blair's, hospital bedside when he felt the urge to confess something that he had been holding on to for years. Maria, feeling both lied to and validated, after all those years was filled with anger. She immediately contacted investigators so that Jerry could tell them what he knew. But their story wasn't shared publicly until after their daughter made a comment on a YouTube video. After this discovery, the story began to be noticed and circulated. Even though Maria only had faint memories and suspicions, Jerry's confession unlocked a truth in her that she knew all along. And that truth was that they too were abducted on the night of October 11th, 1973. According to thesun.co.uk, on the night of October 11th, 1973, Jerry and Maria were sitting in their car, looking out across the river when they saw strange blue lights in the sky. They watched the strange lights for around 40 minutes before getting out of their car and walking down to the pier toward a boat. While walking along the pier, Maria saw something come out of the water on her side of the pier. She described it as a gray man. Jerry, however, dismissed it, and they carried on walking. Maria didn't think much of it until the next day, when the news broke about the abduction of Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson. She discovered that their encounter had taken place at the same time of Calvin and Charles, but on the other side of the river. But Maria never talked about it to anyone, except her family, as Jerry urged her to keep it quiet out of fear of ridicule. It wasn't until 45 years later, after Calvin Parker began opening up about what he really experienced, that Maria herself began talking about it. UFO investigator Philip Mantle and Dr. Irina Scott managed to trace Maria down in 2019. Dr. Irina Scott interviewed Maria and Jerry, who told much of the same story, except that Jerry was quite skeptical about UFOs. But this encounter was intriguing to Dr. Scott, because Maria seemed very emotional about what she saw come out of the water. Later in 2019, Jerry became very ill and was put on a ventilator. He later died that same year. But before he did, he confessed to Maria that they too had been abducted. He had not talked about this before because of the potential of ridicule. Jerry recalled the events from that night in October of 1973. The following are details he shared before his passing. He claims he had seen the same gray humanoid creature as his wife, but remembered just a little bit more. According to Jerry, some of the beings were 6 feet tall and gray in color. Two of them grabbed him and took control of him. One of the beings stood in front of the others, and Jerry got the impression that one was the leader. The creatures floated them onto the ship and performed an exam on him that he didn't want and was refusing to let happen. Maria said that Jerry recalled watching them float back across the Pascagoula River until he no longer had them in his sight. Then he noticed the craft shoot straight up and out of sight. Maria had not remembered the abduction, but Philip Mantle arranged for her to undergo hypnotic regression to jog her memory. She was confused and very scared during the session. She didn't know where Jerry was and wanted to find him. She thought that she was floating in the air and noticed the beings also floated. Then she said something was in control of her. She thought she had been given a sedative, but didn't feel any needle that would administer it. She said that she saw a door open and then was brought inside the craft. She claimed they laid her on a table and hovered a metal device over her private parts, and she thought they were interested in her eggs. She thought their goal was to make children that look like people so they can live among us. She stated, "The aliens need a disguise. They need their children to look like humans so they can roam the earth and look like us." The hypnotist asked why she was chosen, and she said because she was a woman and that the visitors are performing a human-alien breeding program. If that doesn't give you the chills, her next comment might. She stated during her hypnosis session, quote, "They are among us now." Finally, after years of ridicule, Charles and Calvin were finally honored with a plaque at Lighthouse Park in Pascagoula to commemorate the event that changed them and the history of the town forever. In honor of World UFO Day, which is celebrated July 2nd, I would love to hear your thoughts. Do you believe aliens are among us? Do they appear in human form? Do you think you have encountered and interacted with an alien species? Are you one of them? I do want to thank you for embarking on this chilling journey to unlock the paranormal mysteries of the world. For a full list of the episode source material, head over to the Unlocking the Paranormal Podcast Facebook page. And for additional content, be sure to follow us on Instagram at Unlocking the Paranormal. And never miss a moment of the unearthly tales that await by following the show wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is independently produced, and sharing it with friends, family, and your favorite coworker helps me immensely. Don't forget to leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. If you would like to join in and become a paranormal pen pal to have your story shared on a ParaPals episode, email your story to unlockingtheparanormalpod@gmail.com. And stay tuned for our next episode, where we will venture further into the labyrinth of the supernatural. Until next time, stay curious, embark on the journey, and may you find the key to unlocking the paranormal.